afternoon. It's Thursday, March 22nd, and it's my honor to open the meeting for the House Committee on Education, the Subcommittee on Education Innovation. And today, we're very fortunate. We're going to have two major presentations today, and one is about Youth Art Month and special education. And so this, I'm informed that, you know, we might have some other people be joining us as we walk through our presentations, so I hope that won't be disruptive. Any questions or anything for the good of the order before we start with this panel, colleagues?
My question is here tell, is that like a farm thing?
Y'all, I just don't know. I lived in the South for 2 years, and you best not ask me how they talk down there. It's interesting. I can pick up slang so fast.
I'll just brag before we get going, because I mean, arts in my family are singularly important. So, but one of my students just got an email from yesterday who just got accepted as a writer for CSI. He's been in California.
What's CSI?
A TV show.
Crimes. You've never watched CSI.
They have TV on the farm.
Crime scene.
We're too busy
shoveling
other things.
Investigation. It's a nice little. It's a little series that has blossomed into a number of little series.
Okay, and so
he's having a great time as a writer, which is really kind of fun.
Oh, that's great.
You want to brag about your daughter again too? Whatever.
I won't do my. I'll do another friend. You know.
Okay.
We can go through a few other students that are out there writing well.
See, now this is what we do. Now we time that perfectly, so Representative Cannon's here for the full presentation. Isn't that good?
We're vamping.
I just watch it on TV.
Okay. Well, and I don't know if you know background of our panel, of our colleagues here, of the representatives. Representative Wisnett, your background is military?
I have art background.
It's nice that the panel knows who they're talking to.
I've seen the greatest museums in the world in my military career.
There you go.
In Europe. And appreciated them. Last year, I went to the San Francisco Art Museum. I love the Impressionist. Can we turn the machine up? I even took dance as a young man.
All right.
Josie would be proud of you. That's his
I cannot life. Sing, but I can.
And Representative Dahlem? I'm Dahlem.
He's here.
Yeah.
He was high superintendent and administrator.
He'll be in. He's testifying at a committee right now.
And
Roblin?
For me, high school principal at Marshall High School in Coos Bay for 16 years and worked there for 32 years and got to have lots of arts programs at our school, some of which are not doing as well right now, but in the heyday, a lot of programs that were really important for kids and their future lives. And I think we do a discredit when we list art as not one of the main educational parts of what people need to be fully citizens of this country. So, and my all the women in my family, my two daughters and my wife, are all art people, so
good.
It's kind of fun to watch.
Representative Cannon, you want to share your background briefly?
Which one of you is Linda? Okay, I'm a graduate of Westland High School and was at Bolton Middle School before Rosemont Ridge was built. I'm a teacher at a 6th, 7th, and 8th grade at a school that has a major focus on arts. In fact, we're called the Arbor School of Arts and Sciences. I teach humanities, and arts is integrated into our curriculum in significant ways.
I did not know that about my college.
I know. Isn't it wonderful when we talk to each other once in a while?
What didn't you know? Did I'm a teacher?
No, I didn't know.
That's exactly
oh, yeah.
The mindset
right.
In my mind.
Right.
Well, the true artist of our bias here.
My wife is the education director for the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, and my career's been in theater prior to politics. So, I did work for the National Endowment for the Arts as a consultant in the early 90s on the Arts Plus program that we developed a couple programs in Northern California for artist partnerships with schools.
And I bet you could paint a few clown faces.
I could put on makeup. Yeah, absolutely.
Uh-huh.
A whole different thing.
Yeah, it is. It's very different, but it's all form of art, I think.
Oh, so. Exactly.
I'm a middle school principal by trade and high school English teacher, but my art comes in the form of gardening and landscaping, but it's all kinds of art. But with that, I thank you for coming and to share some things about what's happening in schools, and we'll start out with Linda, and if you say your name for the record before you start and where you're from.
Thank you. Thanks, Madam Chairperson and Representative.
Do I have to open the hearing?
Information.
You think so? I opened the informational hearing today about Youth Art Month. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks, Madam Chairperson and Representatives. My name is Linda Keeling. I'm an art instructor in West Lynn. I teach middle school art, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. So say my address.
Mm-hmm. You
2560 Remington Drive, West Lynn, Oregon.
What's your classroom number?
503, no, website. And I'm here representing the Oregon Art Education Association, who sponsors our statewide program for Youth Art Month. Youth Art Month is actually a nationally recognized program since 1961 in cooperation with the Council for Art Education and the National Art Education Association. So what we wanted to do today is to bring that advocacy for those classroom experiences for students kind of up to the forefront. So to go along with the PowerPoint, in today's climate of high-stakes testing, you've got to be asking why art. And I know a lot of you just said that you've had those backgrounds and those experiences from, you know, theater and face painting, you know, through integrated experiences. So we'll make many arguments for the benefits of art education, from higher SAT scores and even keeping kids in school. Elliot Eisner is professor of education and art at Stanford University since 1965, and he's known for his scholarly work with education, curriculum studies, and education evaluation. This is taken from his 10 lessons that the arts teach. The arts teach children to make good judgments about qualitative relationships. Unlike much of the curriculum in which correct answers and rules prevail, in the art, it is the judgment rather than rules that prevail. The arts teach children that problems can have more than one solution. I'm going to have to go all the way up. Let's see if I can get this to work now. Best laid plans with technology.
I'm a very mathematically oriented person, and I usually think of them. But for me, art is like a whole new equation. It's a whole new way of expressing my world. It's an equation with so many different variables that it doesn't even have a right answer. You can't put all the different colors together and create a beautiful new representation of the world.
The arts teach children that problems can have more than one answer, that questions can have more than one answer, that there are multiple approaches to explore different content. The arts celebrate multiple perspectives. One of their large lessons is there are many ways to see and interpret the world. Okay, Emily doesn't want to speak today.
Shy.
Emily's statement says, I like art because everyone can look at it in a different way, and that's okay. The arts teach children that complex forms of problem solving purposes are seldom fixed, but change with circumstance and opportunity. Learning in the arts requires the ability and willingness to surrender to an unanticipated possibility as the work unfolds. The arts make vivid the fact that neither words in their literal form nor number exhaust what we know. The limits of our language do not define the limits of our cognition. The arts teach students that small differences can have large effects.
Modern and ancient, and it's ugly and beautiful at the same time. That's what I love it.
The arts travel in subtleties. The arts teach students to think through and within a material. All art forms employ some means through which images become real. Colin didn't want to speak either. Art can be easily, he says, art can be easily, can be really hard when we are dealing with materials, but I feel great when I figure it out. The arts can help children learn what can be, can learn what to say, what cannot be said. I can't say that either. The arts enable us to have experience when we can have no other source, and through such experience to discover the range and variety of what we are capable of feeling. It's vital that schools are not put in a position to have to choose. Oregon students deserve it. And I deserve to not have to do it.
Art to me is freedom of expression. It lets kids learn to be independent thinkers through creativity and ideas. Art puts beauty in the world and helps reflect society.
We wanted to make sure that you heard the student voices, because although they couldn't be here, that's what this is all about, giving students those opportunities that they need and really want. Thank you. Okay, maybe you don't have any video clips, right?
We're used to it.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairperson and representatives. My name is Aloika Rosendahl. I am here representing the Oregon Art Educators Association. And I teach art at Shoals Heights Elementary in Beaverton School District. So I'm here representing the elementary perspective of teaching art. So I'll start with one of my favorite quotes. How important are the visual arts in our society? I feel strongly that the visual arts are of vast and incalculable importance. Of course, I could be prejudiced. I am a visual artist. So I think that vast and incalculable often are something that adults think about art in general. It's so big. It's just for artists. How could we measure it? But the really interesting thing that anyone who has actually taught it knows is that it's actually very measurable and very teachable if you are a trained teacher. And I have taught elementary art for 7 years, only 3 years here in Oregon. Previously I was in Colorado, where there was a much more substantial program in the elementary schools. I've also taught secondary English in starting in Washington and in London, England, and in Ukraine.
So I apologize for my grammar.
So I have kind of a varied experience that I'm pulling from in this presentation. I want to thank you so much for having us here. This was really exciting and, of course, very nerve-wracking. I got a great letter from one of my students at the end of the day yesterday saying, "Dear Mrs. Rosendahl, you are probably very nerves." So, I want to start just looking at a piece of artwork and talk just a little bit about what it would be like if you were in an elementary art class. When you look at this, it'd be interesting to know what age you guess created this artwork. But I'll give it away really quick because I'm short on time. This is a first grade piece.
Wow.
And I want to kind of explain how does a first grader create something like this. This is a project that would last 6 to 8 art, 50-minute art classes. And in my case, that's, we're talking of 2 to 3 months of work that students dedicate themselves to on one project. For this project, we started out talking about the science of trees to go with the curriculum that they were learning in class. And then artistically, we learned about balance and composition, and obviously color theory went into this. We start out sketchbook journaling, much as you would start out a writing project, and then move on. So a project like this is in-depth, lengthy process that includes learning new skills, taking risks, problem solving, of course, because there's often a day when a kid isn't quite on in a 3-month project where they might not do what they meant to do, and finding a way to solve that, because we can't start over on a project that is that lengthy. One of the modern speakers about arts has kind of come up with this rather complicated, my husband said I should cut this, but but we're just going to go really quick, and I want to just bounce on it because he has come up with so many benefits of the arts in our schools, and this is actually from a presentation he gave in Chicago, who were moving toward taking all Chicago public schools and making them arts-based. And so just really quickly, we can look at some of the things. I think something I won't talk about, but that's pointed out here, cost efficiencies in education. The arts are actually not that expensive to add in. Learning how to learn, students learn a lot of things. This is added in. What I really want to focus on are what I talked about, developing problem-solving skills, habits of discipline, which I was talking about in such a long-term project, striving for excellence, and those opportunities for risk-taking. Learning the arts nurtures motivation, including active engagement, discipline and sustained attention, persistence, and risk-taking. It also increases attendance and educational aspirations. Much of my research in here will come from this specific book, Critical Links, which is the most recent compilation of all university studies regarding the arts in education. So it's coming from this source, but the studies are coming from mostly Harvard, Stanford, and University of California, Los Angeles, maybe not sure on that one. But Critical Links will be the annotation for a lot of the research because they're all compiled there. I've just kind of put some pictures of kids in here. I'm not going to talk about all of them, but I think they just help you visualize a little more what I'm talking about here. So I want to start really focusing on my experience at my school currently, which is a very high-achieving school. It's a higher socioeconomic school, and in the 95th to 100th percentile in pretty much everything. So what does art give to these kids? And that's where I want to talk about keys to excellence. What I've found with high-achieving kids is they've become very reluctant to take risks. They would like to do what they know they can do perfect. And so I think that what I'm finding I'm teaching most to these high-achieving kids is how to take risks, how to then creatively problem solve, how to keep working on the same thing even if they're not confident, and how, if they do those things, they're going to come up with something excellent beyond what they knew they could do. And if they're not doing those things, they're only doing what they knew they could do. And so with these high-achieving kids, we want them to be the top of our future. We don't want them just to achieve what they know they can do because that's what, you know, they're expected to do. So I think that's something in this high-achieving school I'm in now that I really find myself, that's where I think I'm really adding something to their education on top of the joys of creating art. Another first grade tree. The other piece I want to touch on is kind of the flip side of that. I also worked for numerous years in school-wide Title I schools teaching art. And so I've seen personally the achievement gap. I've seen how these kids are at such a disadvantage comparatively in their school. They're just not getting the level of education, and I know that art in that case is very powerful for helping to close the achievement gap. I thought this was a really interesting quote. The arts often create an in-school ecology where students of different ethnicities come together but do not replicate the achievement gaps that are practically universal in schools. And this is based, again, on study. I thought that was a really powerful quote, and it reflected what I see. I'm sure that you've probably seen some of the research, but just wanted to touch a little more on the fact this is a huge study. If you look, it's on a broader sample of 25,000 students cutting across all socioeconomic levels. And what it finds is high art students earn better grades and perform better on standardized tests. And even perhaps more important, high art students also performed more community service, watched fewer hours of television, and reported less boredom in school. You'll see in your paper handout, there's actually a lot more research that I've put in the notes if you're interested in looking in further. To add on to this, a separate study finding similar results. With arts instruction, children are 4 times more likely to be recognized for academic achievement, elected to class office within their school 3 times more often, 4 times more often likely to participate in a math and science fair, 3 times more likely to win an award for school attendance, 4 times more likely to win an award for writing an essay or poem. So it definitely carries over into our other areas, and that kind of goes back to that risk-taking theme that I was talking about. Why do we need it in our elementary schools? There are studies basing a lot of the studies are about test scores, SATs, which is really valuable and it's really measurable, but of course it applies to high school a bit more. We are preparing our kids for that, but there are also studies that suggest that for certain populations, one of them being young children, visual arts are uniquely able to advance learning success in other areas. And the consistent and positive correlations across all of these studies say the availability of arts classes is characteristic of a high-performing school. We want high-performing elementary schools, not just middle and high. So I pose to you these arguments, why art's necessary in the elementary level. First, it is our first and often only chance to reach all students. Sometimes we've lost students already in terms of their motivation to learn, but actually we also lose a lot of students in the fact that once they get to middle and high, they may never take an arts class because it becomes optional. So elementary school is the only chance to get everyone and to reach them in the beginning. It is important to know that No Child Left Behind includes the arts as core academic subjects, not as additional, not as specialized things. It is listed as a core academic subject. And annotated under this one, I found the former Secretary of Education. He was kind of lambasting any school districts or states who are blaming cutting the arts on No Child Left Behind. And so I thought that was interesting because, of course, I've heard a lot of blaming it on No Child Left Behind. Maybe I even did some myself. So, and back again to what I was talking about with our high-achieving kids, children learn early to be averse to risk, to limit their creativity if these traits are not fostered. So where are we in Oregon? I have reached out through the Oregon Art Educators Association. I've emailed, I've talked all year long looking for other elementary art teachers. And I found 9.
We have approximately 740 elementary schools in Oregon. I don't know that many people yet in Oregon, so what if we doubled it and we got 18? Or what if we multiplied it by 10 and we got 90? It's still obviously lacking. Our teachers try, but they're not trained art specialists, and they've got a lot of other stuff on their plate. Last, I want to talk a little bit. My kids have heard that I was coming down to do this, and they, of their own volition, began writing statements, art statements, to support, to that I could come with. A couple of third grades worked collaboratively to write statements, and if you'd have seen how invested, I didn't know they were doing this, and kids just kept coming up to me, Mrs. Rosendahl, when are you going? Mrs. Rosendahl, are you nerves? Mrs. Rosendahl, does this mean we get to have art every week? Mrs. Rosendahl, does this mean that all kids get to have art? What can we do? Can we come with you? Can we write more? What can we do? Can our parents vote on this? And so those letters by those third graders are included in your paperwork, and I just have a few quotes I want to finish with from a few of my fifth graders. Art is a way to express yourself. If you take it away, you're denying children the opportunity to express themselves. And I better make sure the name of that child doesn't show up on the slides. I believe I want to make sure I give the right child a name to you, because she did this in her own time. Yeah, that was Ellen Berkwith, and she's a fifth grader. Art is a great thing for everybody, and everybody should pick up a pencil and draw once in a while. And that's all. And finally, art is a part of my life. It's always with me. If I didn't have art, I wouldn't be happy, and I would not be myself.
That's
Christian Broberg, fifth grade. So, I will pass it on now to our high school representative. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, Madam Chair?
Oh, sure. Representative Wisnett, please.
Thank you for your interesting presentation and your enthusiasm for what you do. You're in a unique situation where you are as far as school specializing. We have 200 school districts in our state, and many in my area or my neighboring counties that are rural Eastern Oregon. Is there any programs to use the computer, the internet, and have, you know, art teachers that the teachers are not art teachers, but they have curriculum that they can supplement their in the lower grades, so everyone has the opportunity to.
That's
experience.
An interesting question.
And let me. I have a second question. Okay. Sometimes I have people that don't allow me to talk on this committee, so because they talk about their, they sort of dominate, but.
At least we know what we're talking about now.
Both parties. From your experience and your education, where do you, we've talked this session a lot about talented and gifted, and we're hoping the budget will allow us to spend some money in talented and gifted programs that we have not in the past. Where do you see, if you say this person has talent and they should be, in a special school or something, at what age do you think that determination could be made that person really needs, a special art?
Do you mean talented and gifted in art specifically?
No, in just an art. If you see a student that you think has a great, art skill or his music and he should be clear.
I can see it in first grade. It's the ones who are exceptional, who come with that talented and gifted. There are elementary kids in third grade who can surpass what I can do. I would definitely say those could be found. And to the prior question, I do not know for sure about any computer programs for doing that. I do know that we, as the Oregon Art Educators Association, would like at very least to get more elementary teachers involved in our fall conference, when we could provide for them more training on and more lesson plans to give more well-rounded and more professional art lessons.
I'd like to respond, if I may. As a middle school teacher, I see the feed up from that when we don't have those programs at the elementary level. And I'd like to speak to the fact that a lot of times this is not about those talented and gifted kids. It's about those kids that are working really, really, really hard. And they're willing to do that. They're willing to take those risks, and they're willing to problem solve. And a lot of times this is where kids are being successful in art and music and drama and theater and dance when they're not being successful academically. So I think this is our opportunity to help them from the ground level to be successful, to be better community members, to include each other. And at the middle school level, I see the differences when we have elementary instruction and when we don't.
Okay. And I'll make a response to that question, too. I ran a fine arts program for 6 years at one of the Salem Kaiser elementary schools. And after the first presentation, a couple of teachers said to me, oh, in fact, several people did, oh, well, this is usually what we have for the TAG students, the talented and gifted. Everyone blossomed. And what happens when we restrict that for a few, many of those little buds that haven't opened up are never discovered. And I felt so validated that everyone in the school got what normally was just offered to the talented and gifted group.
Okay. Now, just a minute, committee. I'm about to lose control.
It'll be short.
Well, just a moment. Now, we do have another presentation today, and we have a wonderful lady here to talk about high school. So,
whatever you want.
Please be brief. Representative Dollar.
I guess this would be to the person that ran the fine arts program. In watching the compelling story that's been laid out, if I substituted the word music or drama, would these things be true, too, in those disciplines?
I think I also taught music to very young children. And in fact, I would integrate some of those things in my art. But I don't think that one replaces the other.
Okay. And one of the discrepancies is there's probably at least three times as many music educators in the state of Oregon than there are visual arts educators.
Okay.
And probably more of us even than there are in theater and drama.
Ms. Philbert, can I have you say your name for the record, please, since you answered a question? We need to know who you are.
I'm Kathy Philbert. I reside at 1180 Lockhaven Drive Northeast. I'm a high school art teacher at McNary High School. And I am the art methods teacher at Willamette University.
Wonderful. Representative Roblin.
All I was going to ask was in conjunction to Representative Wisnett's field. Oftentimes, rural areas don't have arts instruction. Sometimes we do, but there are your organizations have worked to get artists in residence out in programs. And I guess I just want to make sure that people know that there are people out there that are doing that, and you guys have helped make that happen. And you might say a little bit about what artists in residence do. If you can, if you've used them.
Thanks. I think it's this kind of cycle of programs, like at the elementary level, some programs have residency programs who artists will come in and work with students in that kind of studio process for a length of time, maybe an intensive week or over a few weeks. A lot of schools have those arts literacy programs where parents come in, but it's hit or miss. And so it's that vicious cycle of, we have art literacy, why do we need an art instructor? But then it's like, we need an art instructor, but we have art lit, you know, and so it's that kind of band-aid that makes it look like it's fixed.
I agree.
But an artisan residency program, I know there were some highly successful programs at my school before they began this, and I think it was part of what convinced the staff that they wanted to use some of their convertible staffing for an art specialist, because these people came in, they did some really large murals, they spent time teaching kids individually, and they really started to see what could spark in the kids and the value of that with these artists in residence, taking the time to really teach art to the kids.
We're going to move forward because we have another full panel presentation this afternoon. So, Kathy, if you'd go ahead.
Yes, thank you.
We're looking forward to what you have to say.
Okay, and thank you, Chairwoman Kampf and the representatives. And I am representing the Oregon Arts Education Association and specifically high school level. I'm going to just quickly talk about a few of our successes. You
brought up using computer and technology, and we have do use that in the high school level. Beyond the traditional arts that you might have had decades ago, we include computer links with photography, graphic design, and video design production classes. We have classes, AP classes, that provide students with the ability to get college credit. And I should mention to you, digress here for a moment, if you can pull out in your packet this sheet here, I will be making a reference to the last, I'm following along in this, but there specifically, it's the one with the Pablo Picasso quote on the front. Specifically, there, the last two pages are ones that I'd like you to be able to see, or the third one anyway, when I'm talking. And high school, as all levels of art in Oregon, under art teachers, use the discipline-based art education program out of the Getty Institute with some of their some of their lessons, and this includes a much more diverse base. So it includes a context via the art history. It includes aesthetic analysis that really brings student thought into the piece, where there's dialogue about the aesthetics and not a simple, oh, I like that, that's good, or that sucks, but having specific criteria.
You do work at a high school.
Yeah. that are the basis for the aesthetic analysis. There, of course, is the production piece where the students are making their own art, and follow-up with a critique that, again, brings in analysis and a discussion between students and between students and teacher that is far more compelling than simply getting a grade from the teacher. As has been mentioned before, there are many avenues to a successful art piece, so it makes the whole assessment piece much, much more complex, and it really mirrors life that has many avenues to success. We have many high schools that create art and donate it and help in larger fundraisers in the community. It's a wonderful vehicle for our art students to have an exposure to needs in the community and know that their art skills, that their talents can be of benefit to the community. Last year we had in the Salem area a series of high school students that created small 2-foot fingerling fish and decorated them. We had professional artists that had very large ones, but the students in our district, that the high school students, were very successful, and it helped raise money for education in a very positive way. We have high school educators and educators in all levels of art in Oregon who are members of our state and national organization, who've been awarded Fulbright and Fulbright Memorial grant funds, and are very, very well based. We have challenges that I see, and over the years I've taught here in Oregon, I see that we seem to have to justify ourselves increasingly because of the state testing. I have witnessed class sizes increasing and the number of teachers in schools being whittled away. And at the same time, the diversity in the classroom has increased many times over. So that it's not only larger class sizes, and in this, I personally have had classes of over 40, with multiple levels of ability, emotional maturity, and native languages. So those add significant challenges in teaching. I've made a reference to the assessment and how we involve our students many times in the assessment of their pieces. And it's not only in a dialogue, but we may have printed printed forms where we have criteria and they numerically rate themselves and have a written piece that they justify that. So it's a very thought-provoking portion of their development. We use formative assessment many times in visual arts. Formative assessment is making some form, it may not be a test, but some form of appraisal of the work during the process of making the work, which means that by doing it that way, by having a continual assessment, that they are learning in the process. It's not simply an evaluation at the end with a grade, but it's using evaluation as a tool to expand their understanding. Many things have been said here as to how art is an essential part of the curriculum. I have seen increasingly students who were at risk, who are staying involved in high school, who are staying in high school because of the arts. I'd like you to turn to your third page, and it has a picture of our student Tanya and a pal. And this is an example of how art is art offerings at the high school level are absolutely life transforming. And this is an upper end student. There was a national competition run by Lucerne. And so all of the pets, hence the cow, okay? And students could submit a small drawing. They had a template. Then the students would draw in that. Submit a small drawing with their idea for the cow. Tanya's one of only 30 students to receive this almost life-size couple hundred-pound cow. There were over 9,000 entries. And this speaks to how important art is. This, I was just amazed. The cow is now completed as of today, and we're just going to do a clear coat. She's a student who I had last year and who won an award, and then on a local level, and of course this is a huge award. I was absolutely dumbfounded when I phoned their home last week. I talked to her dad, and he said, you know, Tanya had written off college. She said that she had no interest at all in pursuing college. This changed it. She's had 3 awards, one in her freshman year and 2 this year. It has absolutely changed her trajectory in life from not going on after high school in college and seriously now wanting to pursue art professionally. And I share this because we many times think that these incredibly talented students will automatically see the light and want to pursue that, and that is not the case. I was really, really surprised. So this is an example of that, and there's a neat story behind this. She's very much an animal lover, and you know, there are lots of probably people who painted Farmer John on the farm. This is a scene from Africa, and this is a tribe that honors cattle as really very sacred, and she researched that, and she has mourning on this side, and if you were to see the backside of the cow, it's night.
Wow.
It's just incredible. And then not only does art really transform the lives for our most gifted students, but I want to share with you a project that I did. And I learned this because of a Fulbright experience I had in Japan in 2003. This is a Kamichibai stage. And it's a very traditional Japanese storytelling approach. The Kamichibai man would ride around on his bicycle with they often just had a little frame without the stage. But
And he would tell stories to the children in the different villages, and he made his money by selling candy, and those kids got to sit up front. And so this was a project that I introduced into a couple of my classes. It was amazing. The success we had in every single group that did this, and every group completed it. This is a story of Hector and Sonia. And this group had four girls in it, and this is the last page in your handout. It's an article from the Kaiser Times, and it shows the group. And unfortunately, the photographer clipped out one of the four girls, our Japanese girl, which is why we have the Japanese writing on it. I'm not going to narrate the story, but what I want to share with you is how this singular lesson touched so many lives, and I think so profoundly. So this is an example. Here's Sonia wandering around. This is an example of blending art with literacy. The students, initially, we did a lot of different skill-building lessons in terms of learning different media. So this one is done in watercolor and pen, but I have them in colored pencil. I have others that were done in pastel, so that they had lots of art building skills before they did this. Then we talked about adjectives and descriptives, and the incredible thing is how bi-directional, because in the process of learning of illustrating with different details, they were building their vocabulary. So, I'm just going to pull this through here. Now, Hector's found Sonia sleeping under the tree, and Sonia's lost at this point. She doesn't know where she went off on wandering, and she's lost her mother. And Hector the duck has come along. So, this started as an individual project for each student, because each one needed to come up with characters that they illustrated. They needed to develop a storyline. They needed to develop and analyze a storyboard in which they have to, in their story, they need to analyze what are those critical visual pieces that I want my audience to see. And what is the language that's going to reinforce those visuals? So at this point now, Hector, of course, is talking to Sonia and finding out what the problem is. Well, we had lots of different stories. And Sonia finds out that Hector is afraid of water. And behind each one of these is the written piece that the students wrote, so that the final step after the story is written, illustrated, they perform it, and they perform it to the entire class. And this is where, so here we go. She finds out he's afraid of the water there. And Hector relates to Sonia this terrible experience he had as a little duckling, that one of his brothers tried to push him under the water, and he almost drowned. So he has this fear of the water, which, of course, is part of the lovely humor on this. They play hide and seek. And here is Sonia up in the tree. She thought she would hide up there because Hector couldn't find her way up high. Lo and behold, Sonia sees her mother when she's up so high. She gets so excited she falls out of the tree. She falls in the water. And you know what's next. Hector ends up saving her by getting a long vine and throwing it after her and pulling her in. Sonia goes back home to mom. And Hector is no longer afraid of the water. Well, this single project, there were many, many of these Kamichibai stories. And it opened doors for different groups of students. I had a group, one group that self-selected. They were all Hispanic, and half of them had lived very, very limited English. They networked and worked together. And so I had that group not only present to my art class, but to the English language learner class. The instructor for that program could barely believe that the students that I had presenting in my room spoke, because he had never had them speak in his class. And the fact that there's a visual piece helped a lot. And he went on and said, I want to do that, because he said, you can't believe, he said, how important this is. The visual context meant that the audience could, even though they had limited English, could understand this. So he's repeated this very art lesson. Hmm. I had another group of 8 students who are so limited that they will they will never be able to live independently. These are students that are very, very limited. And they created their own story. And I had a different system in working through it, but they completed a story with 12 pictures that's very, very understandable. We have videotaped that group. And there were some people that came in, could not believe these students did that. It was incredibly validating. And the last one is, if you happen to glance at that article, the photographer that came in interviewed one of the students who was a girl that was almost ready to drop out of high school. She had skipped school for probably about 5 weeks, and she starts showing up sporadically and decides that about two-thirds of the way through the semester, maybe she wants to graduate. And is there anything she can do? She hears there's this alternate ed program she could get in, and maybe she could graduate. But in order to get in that, she had to pass a certain number of classes. So I made a contract with her. At that point, there's no group that wants this young woman in their group, because she's always absent, right? So she needs to make her own Kabichi by Story solo. And we shortened the length so that she didn't need a dozen pictures. She can't flip through with such flying colors. She hugged me at the end and said, Mrs. Filbert, you're something else. And she's gone on, and she's presenting this now. She was now in the alternate ed program, and this young woman is presenting to the middle school alternative ed program her Kamichi Vai story about a young girl who goes to a new school, who feels out of place, who finds success in the arts, and is embraced by the other kids. It's very, very powerful. And I would just close by saying, I'd like to give the quote that Pablo Picasso has, art washes away from the soul the dust of everyday life. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For listening.
Thank you. I'll just make one comment before you leave, and that is, beyond teaching art, you are teachers. And it shows. You bring to teaching what is what we call an art. And that's what your students see in you, and that's why they love you, and that's why they do what they do for you. So you're giving your gifts to them, and so thank you.
Thank you for letting us present on behalf of the Oregon Art Education Association in conjunction with Youth Art Month, which really celebrates not just Dury Merge, all the successes, things like we've just heard, but also those struggles that we try to highlight and the successes all year long. So thank you very much for your time and letting us share some of those great stories.
Yes, thank you. It's been
thank
an honor.
You so much. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. It's our pleasure. Nancy, you have a tough act to follow, but I'm going to introduce our special ed panel here this afternoon, and that's Nancy Latina, Assistant Superintendent for the Department of Education, Is Marcy here also? And Janice?
Here, and maybe I'll just sit
and
out.
Catherine?
And Catherine will be back in a minute.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
It puts it on the table.
Okay. With that, as you were transitioning, I'm going to close the informational hearing on Youth Art Month, and then we're going to open the hearing on special education presentation.
Chair Kopp, members of the committee, my name is Nancy Latini. I'm the Assistant Superintendent for the Office of Student Learning and Partnerships. Thank you for asking for some specific information about special education and students with disabilities. Before I start, I feel compelled to tell you that my second year of teaching, my co-teacher was an art teacher who didn't know anything about special education. She was working on her license. And, of course, I thought, how am I going to do this? How are we going to work together with these kids? I was trained in special education. She taught reading using art, and I learned more from her that one year. I just feel compelled to tell that after listening to that testimony.
Well, I didn't want to get this all started because I had, I don't know how many stories in my head.
I bet. Right, so I had a chance.
I just have one.
I have several.
No.
The Office of Student Learning and Partnership has several units, but the area of special education consumes most of our time in terms of federal and state obligations, funding to districts, and also assignments of our staff. This afternoon, I'm going to do four quick things so that you can hear the other people as well. To give you a brief background of special education in public education, the current status for Oregon, and who are responsible for, in other words, who are these kids, as I know you've asked about that, and then how do we serve students and their families, or what is it that the state agency does in order to provide that leadership and accountability. You've heard several names for this law. When it was first passed in the mid-70s, it was called the Education for All Handicapped Children Act, or 94-142. It is now called the Individuals Disabilities Education Act, IDEA, and it just got reauthorized in 2004, and there's this funny story about Congress wanted to put improvement in, so it would be IDEIA. And when they found out how many times in the law they would have to change it and how much time and how much it was going to cost, they only put it in the first line of the law and then said hereafter referred to as IDEA 2004. So I will be talking to you about IDEA 2004 and the school-age children, because you did hear from us earlier, Judy Newman and me, about our early childhood program. I want to give you a context from which generated the interest in having Congress in the first place step into the special ed arena with a federal law. This interest was generated primarily by parents and advocates and attorneys, and here was the situation. At the time the special education federal law was passed, there was over 500,000 children that were outside and not included in public education. They weren't suspended, they weren't expelled, but parents could not enroll them in public education. These children usually looked different or acted differently than what most educators were used to. They would hear things like, take your child home and we'll get back to you when we have something for them. Or they'd say, maybe there's a church school that could help you. And maybe they would say, we don't have kids like this in our schools. So parents couldn't gain access to public education. Very few states at that time had any kind of even permissive education laws, let alone anything that was mandatory. And really, we did not see at that time our responsibility for students with disabilities. The administrative decisions were made on very limited knowledge and or experiences. So parents, advocates, and attorneys wrote a law for educators, and they told us how to get these children in the schoolhouse door. They told us, and they did a very good job of telling us what we had to do and what we were responsible for, including but not limited to writing every year an individual education plan, an IEP, for reviewing individually a full comprehensive assessment on a child to make sure that they were eligible for special education. And all of these little steps had timelines that we had to meet as well. And further, if the public school didn't have a program for these children, the public school would have to find a place and pay for it. That's the free and appropriate public education. That's the background of this law as well. So really, the special education law was written to gain access into public school, and with that access, of course, there were assurances for both children and for their families. They had a set of procedures, and they had access to school, and that was really the focus in the mid-70s when this law was passed. In 1997, there was a reauthorization, and they moved to access to the general education classroom and general education instruction, and that would be the time that you've heard more about mainstreaming, integration, all of those other words, parallel curriculum, inclusion, and that was the time that that was occurring. So then again, there was a major reauthorization in December of 2004. And the focus at this time was really to align IDEA with No Child Left Behind and with all the rules and edits in the special education law to try to align those two. And it brought some good things and some not so good things as far as the new law was concerned. And in handout A in your packet, there's a brief overview of some of those major changes. One of the most difficult things to align these two laws with is that the No Child Left Behind really looks at improving education for all children with an emphasis on low income and other subgroups. So they're looking at groups of children. IDEA, on the other hand, really looks at and focuses on an individual child in assuring special support for an individual child to benefit from education. So there's really a big focus difference, and to try to align these, there's a lot of conversation that goes on around that. Some of the major changes that occurred with this alignment was, first of all, there is now, which hadn't been done as strongly before, a focus on post-secondary outcomes. What is it after we serve these children all these years? What happens to them? So it's accountability, and that's a pretty good thing for us. Assessing the effectiveness of efforts to educate these children. When you're trying something, do you just keep doing more of the same and not changing strategies? That's another form of accountability that we hadn't had in the law before. An alternate way to identify children with learning disabilities, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later, but what they're really looking at is what happens in the classroom with instruction versus only a psychological test that measures the ability of that student and the performance of that student outside of the realm of the classroom teacher and what's going on. Also encouraging the use of mediation before filing for a more formal due process hearing. Mediation, of course, is always an easier way if everybody can agree, and the law is now encouraging that much stronger than before. Specifying and clarifying who can attend an IEP meeting and who has to attend an IEP meeting. And there is now very clear stated when people don't have to be there. But when people don't have to be there, there are certain circumstances. But one that is constant is the parent has to agree in writing that it's okay for that person not to be there. And then there are several new data reports that I will talk about in a minute also. At this point in Oregon, our new statutes for IDEA 2004 were done last legislative session. We had to wait several months in order to get the regulation so we could write our rules. Our rules are done. They've been posted. We've held a public hearing. And hopefully in April, the State Board of Education will vote on them. But in the meantime, we've been busy these last couple of years sharing with all the districts what the law says, sharing forms, posting things on the website to make sure that they did stay in line with the law, even though we didn't have our rules yet. So who is it that we serve? In Oregon, on December 1st of 2006, we reported to the federal government a little over 71,000 children. That's about 12.5% of the school-age population, ages 5 to 21. I'm not going to talk about the preschool kids now. We'll just talk about school age. And the services that these kids get are in a wide range of they can be a regular classroom with some special ed teachers coming in. It can be a regular classroom where the student is pulled out for, you know, like in a resource room, a special class, a separate classroom, private, public, residential facilities, including our school for the deaf and our school for the blind, hospital and homebound situations for some of our children. Our students also have access to, by referrals from the districts, who are regional programs that you know about, and also our ESDs. Or there can be a combination of any of these. Again, very individualized based on what the child needs and what the IEP team, including the parent, discusses that would help the child benefit from education. The growth in special education in Oregon is really not unique. It's pretty much nationwide, and there are a lot of reasons for this growth. There's better diagnosis. The medical improvements have allowed children to live where in earlier years they did not. The modern technology has helped children become more proficient in school than ever before. So these are just some of the reasons. There's better awareness of student needs. We're getting better at looking at who might need the specially designed instruction versus who could get something in another way. Students are eligible for special education if they meet a criteria of one of 11 distinct categories of disabilities. And in Section B, in the very last page, you'll find that list of disabilities and their definitions. That would be an easy reference for you. When a school-aged child is referred for special education, there has to be a referral. There has to be an eligibility that is done on a comprehensive individual assessment, and a team has to decide not only do they meet the definition of disability, but they also have to say they need specially designed instruction. There needs to be something that's special ed. There are kids that are disabled that may not need something in as far as an IEP is concerned, but they just might need some simple accommodations of other sorts. And so the team makes those decisions. Nothing can happen until the parent agrees in writing that the evaluation can start. And the districts are obligated and schools are obligated to keep parents involved in any of the planning that goes on for those children. Our system in Oregon is a single system. We don't sort our kids based on their label. We don't sort them out because they need this service. They have to go here. The team makes those decisions, so you find lots of different kids in lots of different places. When we were doing the budget note, for example, for the school for the deaf and the school for the blind, we got several questions about, aren't these same kids out in the schools? And yes, they are, but those are team decisions as to where best to serve those students. And that is a really powerful decision that gets made at that level. To report on who is in special education in the 71,000 so kids, the department on December 1 of every year collects a set of information from every district on whom they're serving. And in order to get that child on that list, the district has to have a current IEP, not one that's written on December 2nd, but by December 1, they have to have had that meeting with the parent. They have to have an eligibility that's based on an assessment that says this child has a disability and needs special ed. And they also then have to have that child enrolled in school. They can't be on a drop list and said, well, they're coming back December 5th, to be actively enrolled on that day. Let's take a look at some of the children that we do serve. Section B has several. I didn't know exactly what anybody wanted, so I put a variety of forms in here for you. And the first one just shows by grade and disability, because somebody did ask for that. And you'll see each of the disabilities and by grades, and there's a couple of ungraded elementary that we never know where to put, so when we report this to the federal government, we keep them separate because we do not know that. And on the back side is sort of the same information, but in a graph form. You also have some graphs pie-shaped, and I did something purposely just to show you the differences in identification. You have one that is the K-3 as a primary disability, and on the back side you have the secondary, the high school kids, just to show the difference, for example, in the learning disabilities increases, but by the time you have more information on a student, we may have called that child speech and language or other health impaired or something else that we knew they needed some kind of instruction in special ed. But by the time you have more history, you're able to then take a look and have a different set of information. So some of the same kids change disabilities, and again, that is based on an assessment and the team making that decision.
Nancy, right there, I mean, there's quite a contrast between the LD students.
Right.
And so, but do they always stay within the pie, or are some of them moved out of the eligibility?
Some of them would move out and some would not. And one of the interesting things about why I put this in here is most often we don't assess kids with a psychological test for learning disabilities
right.
until they're about in third grade. So it's kind of the wait and fail.
Right.
And when we talk a little later about the response to intervention, we can show you that we can find those kids earlier if we really zero in on what is their instruction
okay.
and how are they doing.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nancy, can you just give me three or four specific learning disabilities so I know what that category is?
Learning disability is really, right now it's a discrepancy between what a child can do and what they're able to do. And so it's really not a set of categories. You could talk about dyslexia. You could talk about processing problems. You could talk about reading disabilities, math disabilities. Again, it's based on that functioning areas.
Thank you.
The next graphs are just pie-shaped again. Pie graphs, again, are showing over time some of the differences. Our placements, if you notice, our majority of our kids are in the general education classroom, and that's why we stress so much that when we do our work, we should be always considering that general ed classroom and what's happening there, because so many of our kids are there. And the very last page shows some graphs on the numbers of kids, and you can see the bottom one. We've been hovering around the 12% for quite a few years now. We're also asked a question about autism spectrum disorder and those numbers. And the next, just a running list of the numbers by years. It should not be added up at the bottom. That's one of the problems with these programs. And I didn't catch it before it got printed. X that out, because some of right. those are the same kids. It's just year by year.
Yeah. They do what they want to do, those programs.
I know. And, you know, if you don't remember to look, you just... Don't catch that one.
It's kind of like autism, yes.
I just kind of looked at it and had to put the numbers down.
It just had to do it.
So I'm going to talk just a little bit about what we do as a state agency, and if you have questions about any of those numbers, just feel free to stop me. IDEA 2004 specifies requirements for serving the students and their families, and the most critical work that we do is around the review of performance and compliance of school districts. We're obligated to do that. They set aside a set of IDEA funds that says this is what you use this money for. But what we've done is we've moved to a web-based system of compliance review. And in the fall, we do regional trainings with all the districts to show them what's new in the law, remind them of how they do file reviews for their student records, and then they go ahead and do that and give us back an evaluation that we verify. And then at that time, we'll help them with wherever they are. And similar to a lot of things that we learn about is that the districts are harder on themselves than we might be if we were out there. But it is amazing to walk around our office, and I'll hear a staff person on the phone with a computer looking at somebody's information, and the district and the special ed director, somebody's on the other end on the same screen, and they navigate through some like districts, like characteristics and size or whatever it is, and they start looking at what the results are and if they're different, and then navigating to another site that says, well, here are some ways you might want to improve on your outcomes. And it is amazing to watch that happen, because it saves on a lot of time for staff to be out of the office or be on the road. And definitely what we hear from districts is it's a much friendlier system than the ODE staff coming out for 5 days and being in town with you. And yet we do go out to the face-to-face, but it's like an overnight or one day with them, and especially if they ask or if they have big needs. And so that's what we've done, and it works really well for us. On Section C, there's a one-page brief description of that process. The department also has to assure and make sure that parents understand what their rights are, and we make sure that assure that they know that, and that all districts are following those and parents are informed. Beyond that, we have a small legal team in our office. They help parents and districts when they need mediation services. We help parents through other dispute resolutions. We monitor complaint investigations, and if there are findings and corrective actions, we're the people who watch to make sure those happen when people agree to what they're going to do to make it better. We're the ones that monitor that. The due process, formal due process, is hearings in Oregon are usually in the single digit annually, and that's very unusual. Most other states at least get to 10, and we've been really down below that. Oregonians, I do believe, like mediation. They like dispute resolution at a more local level, and we like that too. It's always more friendly if people can figure out those things together without outsiders. This year, for the first time under IDEA 2004, we're also obligated as a state to report on performance of school districts. And this was new for us, and what we decided to do was make it look like the report card that everybody else is very used to. Yep. And in Section D, you'll see some of the indicators that we had to use, and we'll be adding new ones next year. We only had a few this year. And on the back side, there's an article from Oregon Public Radio that they had put together. They interviewed some of the special ed directors, and far more positive than I expected it to be. But I tried to get the school districts that were close to you so that you have some interest in what the outcomes were for them at this time. And I have a couple of early childhood ones in there as well. These are out already. The school districts are now getting them out to the public, and they're on our website.
Excuse me, Nancy. So are these included within the regular report card, or this is a separate?
What we thought we'd like to see happen is have them included at the same time. Mm-hmm. But as usual, the federal government gave us this requirement at a time that it didn't match.
It didn't fit.
And we still had to collect our information. Hopefully next year we can do that. We have a couple superintendents that are including it in their next newsletter that's going
sure.
home. So somehow to get it there with ease
okay.
and not have to pay for it. Approximately 90% of the IDEA funds that come to the state of Oregon goes directly off to school districts and programs in flow-through dollars that they use to enhance services for kids with disabilities. Another 8% that is kept at the department is used for what we call local capacity building. And these are funds also that go out to districts, but they go out in different ways. They might go out for specific grants or specific training events or some kind of planning processes. And this is some of the most exciting and interesting work that we do, is helping to build capacity. The department takes many of the best practices, takes them out to districts that have some interests or abilities to carry them out locally and make them successful. I'm going to talk about a couple of them in a minute. Some of the examples are in the compliance review that I talked about earlier, that's web-based. We give every district a small grant based on the number of special ed kids they have, so that they can pull teachers out, or they can bring parents in, or they can do something to help them enhance that analysis at their level. This past year, we spent some money on traumatic brain injury training. Last year, we added traumatic brain injury as a service in the regional programs, and so we thought this year the best thing to do is to do some training around how do you identify students with traumatic brain injury, and what does it mean, and how do you support them. We do things in dropout prevention. We've done some stuff on secondary transition planning. We also have an education evaluation center that's available to all districts when they're having difficulty evaluating a student, or parents might have some questions about wanting an outsider evaluating of their child, that we have that access for them. This year we also did some major training, as you know, about the new extended assessments, and so we put money into there to get staff to be trained on that. There are three capacity building things I just want to share briefly with you that have been really exciting for us. And one has to do with response.
Yes. Then could you summarize after that?
Yes. That'd response to intervention, and you have a summary of that in your packet. On the back side are the school districts that are involved right now, in case you have school districts that are there. The other one is positive behavior supports, and again, the Tigard-Tualatin School District is helping us with the response to intervention because they've been a master at it for about 10 years. Lincoln ESD is helping us with the statewide on positive behavior supports. And again, on the back, you'll see some of the school districts involved there. And finally, the autism model classrooms that we're working with Portland State University. And these are programs, model classrooms, we have 40 sites right now across the state of Oregon. What our hopes are is that the model classroom is a site for certain students that need a special class placement, but they also are training sites for other teachers, and they're also training sites and support for parents. And what this will do is, for parents who have students with autism, they're not going to have to come to the metro area to get their services, but they can stay at home and get services in their local communities. We're pretty excited about that. So thank you for asking me, and you have some really important people here I'd like you to hear from. And
what a wealth of information.
Okay.
Did you have any questions at the top of your mind? That
no, we've decided not to ask any.
Since you've been criticized today, around.
Could you please call on Jean?
Okay. Are you Marcy?
Yes, I am.
And okay, Marcy, if you'd start out with sharing who you are and right. What your title is.
Thank you, Chair Comp and members of the committee. My name is Marcy Engledew, and I'm here on behalf of the ARC of Oregon, the State Advisory Council for Special Education, and as a parent of three children currently in the public school system, and one of whom benefits from the wonderful services we receive through special education. It's an honor and a privilege to have this opportunity to share my perspective of special education in Oregon. First with the ARC, since that's what I'm currently employed with the ARC, but have had a long relationship with the ARC for years since I am a parent also. The ARC holds a rich tradition in the education of children with disabilities. We were founded over 50 years ago, and the roots began with the families that chose not to put their children in an institution. The families that said, no, we want more for our children and we want an education. So those families got together and they raised funds, they did bake sales, they did whatever they needed to do to provide an education for their children. And so in church basements around the country, children began becoming educated because of those parents. And that's really the history of who the ARC is. since the establishment of the ARC so many years ago, we've worked at various different levels. We're affiliated with the ARC of the United States, and as well as many chapters all over the country. In Oregon, we have 14 local chapters, and they are grassroots members. Because we have so many chapters and members nationwide, the ARC is the 10th largest nonprofit in the United States, and we just found that information out and was pretty impressed by that. We work diligently at the state level for the ARC of Oregon to assure that that we represent our 14 chapters and our grassroots members that can't always get to Salem to come and testify. It's been a high priority for the ARC of Oregon since its inception that we provide advocacy statewide and that we make sure that there's programs and services with individuals with developmental disabilities. And because of who we are in the ARC, we work from birth to death. So we're trying to grab it all for all those individuals that need to be included in their community. We look forward to providing information to you so that you can understand what we deal with on a day-to-day basis. As you all well know, the education system in Oregon has many, many diverse learners, not just children with disabilities. But children with disabilities are a part of that blend, and the successful future for the children with disabilities, from my perspective, is the inclusion in the education system. This is not an easy task, but it's a task that can be successful when we collaborate and communicate across all facets of the education system. The ARC of Oregon advocates for a positive educational outcome for all students. We collaborate with the Department of Education, the Oregon Parent Training and Information Center, the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities, and many other agencies statewide. We work together to address the challenges of ensuring an appropriate education. In addition to the work for the ARC of Oregon, I've had the privilege to be the member and currently chair the State Advisory Council for Special Education. The SACSE, as we call it, is a federally mandated council required by IDEA and serves the state school superintendent and the ODE in an advisory capacity regarding the education and services for children with disabilities in the public school system. Our membership consists of 50% family members or individuals with disabilities, in addition to a variety of agencies representing and working with children with disabilities. We are extremely fortunate that Superintendent Castillo and Assistant Superintendent Nancy Latini have worked closely with our council to establish priorities and goals that will allow a positive educational outcome for all children. We work on a variety of issues and concerns. We struggle to remember that our place is to provide input to the department and advice when we sometimes want to do more than that. But we always get put back in our place. We work on a variety of issues such as the state performance plan, transition, personal development, many, many issues the department has to face and Nancy kind of alluded to in her presentation. But the most important part of my perspective today, I feel, is my most important job, and that's as a parent. 15 years ago, our family began a new journey. After the birth of our son, Joey, we were told that he had Down syndrome. And at that moment, our lives changed forever. We began a long road to understanding and embracing our new lives. At first, it was hard. At first, we wondered, what was our life going to be like? What did we need to learn? But then we remembered that Joey was our child first and that we could have dreams for him just like any of our other children. It's these dreams that have kept our advocacy work alive. So since our dream, and I've given you a handout that kind of talks about Joey and from his perspective, or he thinks it's from his perspective, his mother kind of tends to add that information. But our dream for Joey is once we got a handle on what happened after he was born and we learned he had Down syndrome, we decided what was going to happen, and our dream for him is that he was going to have every opportunity every child in the state has. And that opportunity is to become someone that's included in their community, who is happy and who has choice and self-determination in their lives. And we expect him to become a tax-paying citizen. His parents do anyway. We want him to be independent. So we are fortunate because Joey has attended his neighborhood elementary school, his middle school, and he's currently attending Grants Pass High School, which is hard for me to swallow at this point. But we attribute his success and his accomplishments because of the inclusive education that he's received and the access to the general education curriculum. It's not always been easy, and it's not that our district always has agreed with our philosophy. But when we've worked closely with our school district and our administration with respect and communication, we feel like anything is possible, and we really feel that Joey is a success story. As you can see from the handout, he's participated in a community kung fu class, his YMCA swim lessons, his yearly basketball league at the local Boys and Girls Club. He loves his friends and his activities, and I'm not sure if he even understands that he has Down syndrome. But his most current activity is participation in the marching band. And I don't know if any of you were in marching band growing up, as I was, but marching band has changed over the years. And it's very, very competitive. And so the fact that he chose to do that and he chose to do the work at the beginning with some supports and then later on with the supports of his fellow musicians, he's been very successful. So we're pretty excited about that. In fact, we usually talk about the fact that his true disability at this point is that he's a teenager, and he pretty much acts like a teenager. I just want to thank you for this opportunity to present maybe a general overview of our perspectives of it, special education and the interests that we have as a family, and we feel that maybe this success story will help other families to also enjoy the benefits of special education. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. This is a mom talking, not a representative. Does he have a girlfriend yet?
He's constantly looking. And it's in the plan.
That's good. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the work you do with ARC as well.
Thank you. Yeah. It's just, I can't imagine you being in the marching band. With that, we have three more people. We have about 20 minutes left here to our committee meeting. So if Marcy, and, well, that was Marcy. If Janice and Catherine and Karen. Is Karen back there?
Karen Trey.
Oh, Karen. And so Catherine's coming up and Janice. And I you can choose any order that you would like to present.
Okay. Well, hi. Good afternoon, Chair Comp and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Janice Richards. I am a parent first of a child with a disability, and I'm also the executive director of the Oregon Parent Training and Information Center. This is Karen Ripplinger. She's also a parent of a child in special education, and she's a trainer for the Oregon Parent Training and Information Center. And we're going to kind of share tag team on this a little bit. Some history about who we are is the Oregon Parent Training and Information Center is a private nonprofit organization committed to serving parents of children with disabilities. Our goal is to educate and support parents, families, and professionals in building partnerships that meet the needs of children and youth with the full range of disabilities, ages birth to 26. Due to the diversity of our state, Oregon PTI believes that in order to meet the needs of the parents, we must utilize a model with staff living in the area that they serve. ORPTI advocates for the rights of all children with disabilities to a free, appropriate public education and all related services. We provide a full range of services and a variety of modalities statewide to help Oregon families. These services include bilingual workshops, trainings, information and referral, a special education helpline, technical assistance, bilingual newsletters, statewide conferences, and an IEP partner training and matching. ORPTI has been effectively serving parents of children with a full range of disabilities since 1984. Our organization has been responsive to the changing circumstances surrounding special education in the state of Oregon. This has been achieved by incorporating emerging research and best practices into our services and materials and by working collaboratively with the Oregon Department of Education, Department of Human Services, and other related agencies. We were asked to bring a testimony about special education in Oregon from a parent organization's perspective. So with that, we looked at and put down things and information that parents have talked to us about or have called us on our special education helpline, and we just thought quickly we would summarize some of the strengths in our state and then also some of the opportunities that we see we'd like to focus on. So,
well, thank you. I'm going to address the strengths that we see in the state and other parents see in the state of Oregon.
Karen, I'll need you to state your name for the record.
My name is Karen Ripplinger.
Thank you.
One would be access to the general education curriculum. As Nancy mentioned, most of the students are served in their general education classroom. It's one of the few states that have a written definition of access to general education curriculum. Response intervention, as Nancy mentioned, is one of the things that school districts are starting to implement. Not all districts in Oregon are implementing response intervention yet, but several are in the works and setting up that program. Special education is a wait-to-fail system, but response to intervention addresses that those failures much quicker, and I think we'll see good results from that. In general, I believe that most Oregon schools are doing it better than most states in providing educational instruction for their children with disabilities in the least restrictive environment, which is the general education classroom in most cases. Educators appear to be doing a good job making sure that each student has an IEP and has an annual IEP meeting, which is required by law. Mediation is an excellent tool for dispute resolution between parents and educators. The Department of Education now pays for all mediations, and we have seen an increase in mediations across the state, and they have an 85% rate of coming to agreement through mediation, which is good for parents. Because of No Child Left Behind, educational assistants, paraprofessionals, and Title I schools are now required to complete 2 years of study at a college or university in childhood education. This is a requirement that Oregon schools are following up on or attempting to, and in the end will benefit all of the students that they assist, especially children with disabilities. Schools are providing parents with their procedural safeguards. It's a booklet, and it's also available on the Department of Education's website. Many people are concerned about the growth in numbers of kids identified with autism spectrum disorder, but there are now more autism supports for teachers and students in the classrooms. In 1988-89 school year, 218 students were identified with autism. Today we have 6,374 identified. While this increase is significant, students with autism spectrum disorder represent only 8% of the children identified with disabilities. The ongoing working relationship that Oregon PTI has with the Department of Education is positive and needs to continue and expand so parents can have an impact on the issues that affect them in the process of special education. Having a specialist available at the Department of Education to answer parent questions and give accurate, up-to-date, and reliable information is immensely helpful. And then providing access to co-sponsored trainings and conferences that include parents and professionals training together on various topics. This model of effective collaboration between parents and professionals. And I'm going to give it back to Janice, unless you have any questions about the strengths.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a good list.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to just briefly go over some opportunities. We actually first called this the good, the bad, and the ugly, and then we decided, you know what? It's just opportunities because we know that we're working towards moving these over to strengths. So
Clint Eastwood would appreciate
that. Yeah, exactly. So some opportunities we have. Special educators and other professionals working with our children with disabilities are not being given the supports they need at the local level, financially, emotionally, or training. We find that a lot of times the teachers that are working with our children are spending so much time doing the paperwork that the actual instruction time is limited. Mm-hmm. They are underpaid and have large caseloads. And general education teachers need more training on the use of implementing accommodations for kids with disabilities when working with students with disabilities in the general education classroom, which is where we want our children, but they need to have the accommodations that they need there. Some parents are running into resistance when making requests for additional IEP meetings to address concerns. In some cases, their requests are not being made in a timely manner by the districts. implementation at the IEP at the local level continues to be the biggest concern that parents have in our state, is getting those goals and objectives accomplished on that IEP. Parents have stated that it's difficult to have a collaborative relationship with the district at that level. They would like to be more involved with special education. Some progressive districts have what they call, as Marcy had mentioned, is the State Advisory Council on Special Education. They have a local special ed advisory committee, and they've had resistance from the districts in allowing parents to have that there at the local level and then to also provide trainings for those parents there. We really feel that the more training that parents can get, the better they can advocate for the child, the outcomes are better, they're more empowered. So we would like to see that change. Non-responsive district administrators and staff to parent requests for information to observe specific programs or just the classrooms that their children are in, because obviously the parent knows the child best, and we feel if we could go in and observe, maybe we could work at trying to accomplish maybe some of the difficulties that they might be having with our children in the classroom. Negative response to the transfer of foster children into school districts, especially children who are in therapeutic foster care. Some districts bar children from registering kids for their school and do not provide services in a prompt manner. And we've had complaints that it's been up to 2 weeks before these children get into the proper placement. Outreach by districts to Native American families to the reservations include the monitoring of the Indian education programs to make sure that the Indian students with disabilities do have improved outcomes. It's a big concern for our Indian families. The modified diploma and the alternative certificates, they're not defined at the state level. They're defined at the local district level. And so we would really like to see, and I know the Board of Education is also looking into to this, and it's something that's been on their agenda, is that those things need to be defined at the state level so that it's consistent throughout the state. We've had parents calling us in the past because their child would be receiving a modified diploma or an alternative certificate and not be allowed to walk in graduation with their class because it wasn't a standard diploma. And we feel that our kids work just as hard as the kids that are receiving a standard diploma and should be allowed to walk with their peers at graduation. School personnel blaming special ed students for not making AYP, annual yearly progress, or being sanctioned because the test scores of kids with disabilities have brought their scores down. We have had numerous calls on that over the last couple of years, and we'd like to see a change in the way that they're thinking at the district level about our kids. Students are being bused to self-contained classrooms outside of their communities, but within the district. We gave some examples there, but this is a large issue for a lot of our students, because even though it is within the district, it could be a 30 to 45 minute bus ride to a self-contained classroom when they could easily be educated in their local school. Medically fragile children, balancing the least restrictive environment and safety needs, lack of funding, increasing costs of services and equipment, difficulty assessing Medicaid funds to offset costs of services to medically fragile students. And then the last one is transition plans for students, not preparing them for adult life, including post-secondary education, employment, and community living. Youth transition programs, YTP, which we believe is a wonderful program, is not available in every district, and every student doesn't have access to that. So thank you for the opportunity to share our thoughts from a parent's perspective, and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Janice. We're going to move forward in here, Catherine, before we run out of time, but just that you know that there were several things that a number of us noticed, that we have some bills that are written to address some of these issues.
Yes.
Here.
Okay. Thank you.
Good.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Catherine White, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities, which is a federally funded policy advocacy and systems change council. And I think that Janice did a great job of listing many of the things that I was going to list, so I'm not going to go there. I want to apologize for bouncing in and out. The early intervention, early childhood special education program that you heard about earlier is being heard in Ways and Means shortly. And so we have quite a number of young families here to talk about their services. So if you are looking for another committee hearing, you might want to pop in.
We're appreciative that you're taking care of that.
For many families like myself, our involvement with special education goes on for many years, 20 years or more. And as many of you know, the relationship between families and the schools and the teachers in special education go way beyond education. It is, and I know from hearing from many of your experiences, you understand this is an extremely emotional interaction between families and schools. And I think that it is really critically important to recognize the emotion behind that interaction. Special education is where your dreams are realized, where your hopes are shattered. And I think often school people receive the brunt of that kind of emotion. And I know families feel that emotion intensely. It doesn't matter who you are or what you do in your other life. When you come to that IEP meeting, you're sitting at the table and you are nothing but a parent who's desperate for some help for their child as you face that line of professionals across the table. And I think that we can talk about what all the issues are and what all the achievements are. I just wanted to raise how critically important it is to recognize the emotional level of what goes on in special education, because it becomes the underlying theme for much of what happens. It is an opportunity for miscommunication. It's an opportunity for misunderstanding. It is clearly overly litigious and overly confrontational. And I think that it is a challenge for all of us to deal with that issue and how we support families in a constructive and a supportive way, and support teachers in what is a highly charged and highly emotional situation. I also wanted to make the point that education is only a small part of the lives of children with disabilities. We desperately need and are desperately underfunded in mental health care for children, respite care for families, supports and in-home supports for families, children struggling with autism, families struggling with their children with autism. These are services that are grossly underfunded, and that frequently schools bear the brunt of that underfunding with an expectation to pick up services and call them education when often they're social services. So that's all I wanted to add to what I thought was an excellent list of some of the issues. And thank you very much for the opportunity.
I'm just going to make one comment to see if there's any other committee members for a comment. Catherine, I really appreciate your additional perspective about the emotional charged meetings. Well, and I've sat through, I can't tell you how many special ed meetings, and I want to acknowledge the work of one of our colleagues. Representative Roblin has been working on a bill that is all about how we can better serve our families, and that is by mentoring our teachers and administrators.
Yes.
That can do more for any of these issues right now than anything else that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. I remember distinctly being in a special ed meeting with teachers and a parent, and I always, and my teachers knew I started a meeting this way, I want you to say one positive thing about this student. And I actually had a teacher say, I can't think of anything, in a meeting. Mm-hmm. And you talk about emotions. But what happens in those meetings is everybody feels like they've failed the child frequently. And so then we're always trying to, you know, it's incredible that, and seriously, if we can help our administrators and our teachers understand that we're all people, mm-hmm. and we're here for the best plan we can make with our children. So thank you for sharing that perspective. Representative Dahl and then Moblin.
I would want to say, after having sat in a multitude of those meetings, and I've sat in the ones that you talked about,
mm-hmm.
And as depressing and as gut-wrenching as they are, when you achieve success, it's equally as exhilarating. So I wouldn't want us to think that all or a majority or even a large minority are failures. When they are failures, it is terrible. But sometimes they're very successful. And that doesn't mean we don't have a problem, we don't have to address it. But when you see an inch of progress, it is so gratifying. When you consider where you started and the people that were in the room and how hard they worked and how hard that child worked. And I think we certainly want to remember that too, because it gets very easy to talk about the difficulties, and they are bad. And they are difficult, but let's remember the successes.
Absolutely. Representative Roble?
Thank you. This has been a part of my life. I have a brother that's severely learning disabled, and actually two brothers and myself have learning disabilities. And my mother's battle with the school system, of which her husband was a member, was legendary in our school district. So it goes a long way in our school. And in Washington, when they started taking young people out of institutions who should never have been there, and my mother was one of the people that helped with houses in our town to make that happen, and we had a lot of visitors come to our home who we had to help figure out how to get them back where they were supposed to be, but they knew there was a place to come. So this is one that is always emotional, and I guess what I have always believed, because I haven't been to any IEP meetings that I thought were bad. I mean, I enjoyed every one I went to. So, but I entered into it in a different way than most people did. What bothers me is that we had to have had IDEA and the complicated stuff that has come along with it. And, you know, and we didn't need to have it. I mean, I hate to say that too, but the problem is that it has reduced the ability from some of our best trained teachers to do the job they should be doing, which is teach the children. And so often it is our classified people who are teaching the children while they're off doing
paperwork,
which we need to get a handle on that, in my opinion. I tell administrators and teachers every time I talk to them that there is no one who walks into the room who knows the person better than that parent. And so the first thing you need to do is take a deep breath, because you think you're the professional, and just listen. Because that person wants what you want, and that is to teach that child. And if more people would just do that, just suspend all their stuff and just sit there and listen to the parent. I'm not saying that all parents are, how would I say that?
Thanks.
Understanding and understanding of the conditions of the school and other kinds of things and expectations are realistic. But they really do know their child, and they know the things, and they know how best to teach their child. And so often we forget to ask that question. And I, hopefully in my time at the high school and working in lots of what other people said were contentious situations, they came to us contentious. They hardly ever left that way. And the reason was, once the parent realized that the school cared about their child, all their tension went away too. And I will contend it's really nice to have you come and talk here. You do it with passion, but you know, you're calm about your passion. You aren't angry. And what happens is our system has so often developed anger in people because they haven't been listened to for a long time. And so, you know, I appreciate you coming. I appreciate having this information, and I hope that we keep getting information out to people in schools that parents aren't coming to attack you. They are really coming to help their child. And we need to take a moment and listen for a while, because you can also hear in their voice all the pain and struggling they've gone through. And it's 24 hours a day for the parent.
That's right.
And we only have 4 or 5 hours. So a reminder of that. So, again, I want to thank you for taking the time to do this, because it takes people who are willing to articulate for their children for us to make the improvements we need to make. So thank you for being here.
Last comment. We got 30 seconds.
Mr. Chis, do you have a website for your organization?
Yes, we do. It's very easy. www.orpti.org.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Representative Cannon, one last word. The teacher.
Anything to say? I would say only that I appreciate you coming, and I think that having this kind of setting where we can listen and learn and have you share is really important, partly to model what we hope can happen in schools as well. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're going to close the public hearing, informational hearing meeting on special education. Really appreciate that. And close our meeting. And Representative Roblin, it's all yours.
I get the room now.
Thank you.